You're listening to The Bells of Mincemeat, Part 2. Alice's heart began to beat strangely as the figure raised a hand in greeting. It was Thomas. She half raised a hand back, her astonishment surely visible to him. She slowly walked towards the door, hearing his footsteps mirroring hers outside. It felt like too long before the eventual knock came, each rap of the hand piercing the quiet of the room. She didn't know why, but she didn't open the door. Instead, she leant the weight of her body against it, her forehead touching the cool wood. He didn't knock again, but nor did he walk away. She felt one light thud against the door as if he, too, were now leaning against it. There was silence for a few seconds.
Alice?
She didn't answer. She couldn't believe he was here. Nor could she believe the way she was acting. Why couldn't she just open the door and invite him in like any normal person? She felt her eyes prickle with tears, the tears that had refused to come for months, even at her father's funeral. She wiped them on the back of her hands. Why were they coming now? She traced her fingers on the door, around where she guessed his shoulders might be. But she still couldn't open it. There was a lot she'd push back or down. She didn't know what would happen to those things if she did open the door. Thomas didn't say anything else, but since there'd been no other movements, she guessed he was still there. She knew, he knew, she was still there too. Alice felt all of her senses heightened. The door that had always looked one colour was now, she realised, made up of a multiple of hues, and there were patterns within it she'd never noticed. She traced one of the knots with her finger to the sound of the fire crackling and popping, the loudest it had surely ever been. And the knowledge of their bones, practically embracing if not for the oak between them, was, despite everything, thrilling. Though she'd had a previous relationship of 3 years, this moment in early December, two bodies suspended in silence, was, strangely she realised, one of the most electrifying of her life. She hardly dared to breathe. Why was he here? There was something about the way he'd addressed her that said this wasn't small talk. He'd come here to tell her something. The silence that remained between them had a pulse to it, the sea lapping back and forth in the distance. Alice lost track of time. He may have been there a minute, he may have been there 10, but at last she heard movement and Thomas's footsteps walking away from the door. With each step, she felt a wash of panic, desiring to open the door and yell out to him. But she bit down on her lip, walking back to the arm of the chair and sinking into it, this year's tears all at once finding their inevitable release. She didn't sleep upstairs that night, but placed her coat over her as she lay down next to the fire, pleased for the sight of the glowing embers and, visible through the window, the shining stars outside. The next morning, Alice was wringing out sheets when she saw one of her neighbours walking down the beach and disappear into the fog. She also heard shouts and commotion some way off. She hung up the final sheet by the fire and headed outside towards where the voices were coming from. There was some kind of a group ahead. Despite it only being around 10 a.m, as ever these days, she brought her lantern. She realised, with some trepidation, she was heading in the direction of the abbey. She carried on towards the voices and saw a handful of her neighbours surrounding the building. Moving closer through the fog, she saw horse-drawn carts and several of the white cannons throwing objects into them.
It's okay. It's not like we could do with any help right now.
Sarah Edwards stood looking up at the religious men, her hands firmly on her hips. Alice moved closer to the carts and saw they were almost full with the canon's belongings, including food, clothes, lamps, and books. Leaving. The canon's horses had been brought from a neighbouring field, and she now saw around half of the men already sat upon them.
Where are you going?
Sarah continued to challenge the men, her chin jutting straight out as a cart laden with food began moving past her. The canons continued their business in silence to the protests of the villagers. As several of Alice's neighbours began moving towards them swinging lanterns, the rest of the carts began to move, as did most of the solo riders on horseback. Alice then noticed a figure standing on the cliffs nearby. As a billow of fog moved upwards to reveal his face, she saw it was Thomas, staring out to the sea. He stood still, and in that moment, she realised he had been the figure she'd spied far away on those many moonlit nights, always staring east across the water. She waved her hand at him, not sure what to do. She saw his eyes flicker before turning sharply and walking towards the horses. She felt like her insides had been hollowed out as she watched him mount the remaining horse and ride off after the carts into the fog. After 200 years, that was the end of the White Canons at Minsmere. With the canons gone, the mist became thicker over the small village on the east coast. In between laps of the ocean, odd noises that couldn't be identified were now heard coming from the water. Those who fought off the illness only did so to then become ill again. With this, it became hard to shake off a hopelessness that had now settled on the village, denser than the fog. Since word had got out about the supposed spirits on the marsh, their neighbours in Theberton no longer wanted anything to do with the village. They must have brought it on themselves, went the tongues. None of their people would risk their souls walking onto that godless coast anymore. And so, no more deliveries of food came. The villagers forced to look solely to the ocean for their food, a sea that seemed not to want to feed. Something had changed in the village. People seemed to be existing in a type of half-life, a new state that was verging closer to sleep than wakefulness. Alice felt like the edges of her body were being rubbed out. Local talk said perhaps it had been the canons who'd kept the marsh spirits at bay, and now the men had left. Who knew what lay ahead? With no input from the outside world anymore, the odd, the surreal, were no longer so, but became the everyday. The villagers spoke of the deserted religious settlement in increasingly feverish terms, pointing in the direction of the abbey across the beach, the white of their eyes visible. Not for the first time as of late, Alice heard bizarre rumours drifting across the community. This last one concerned the now empty abbey. It was said that, uniquely in the village, no mist surrounded the building anymore. Even on days you couldn't see your own hand in front of your face, the abbey remained completely clear, as if possessing its own type of armour. The abandoned building began to obsess the villagers. Those who weren't bedbound started accumulating around it, hovering nearby, without clear direction like the walking undead. Alice heard a couple of people had even begun sleeping in it, starting up the old fireplace so the chimney smoked for the first time in months. There was a feeling of peace, of security within the building, too, that all reported. Rare qualities these days. Spring was now giving way to summer. The rise in temperature couldn't have been more welcome. If you opened your window in the early morning to the sound of the waves and cries of the gulls, it was possible to imagine this had all been some odd fever dream, something to be blinked away over breakfast as a couple of cannons walked past your window, the chores of the day gradually presenting themselves. It was the middle of May. The moon had been full 3 nights ago, and Alice stared at it, transfixed, on her usual twilight walk. She used the light the moon gave through the fog, coupled with that of her lantern, to make her customary way to the beach. Tonight, she felt drawn to the ocean, calmed by it. She appreciated the lulling rhythm of the waves as they broke and the damp seaweed smell of the shoreline. Almost in a trance, she walked closer so the waves washed over her shoes. She didn't flinch, but setting her lantern down on the sand, continued walking further into the sea. She wasn't worried about the piercing ice cold or how she gasped as she waded further. She almost welcomed the oblivion of the darkness ahead. But what was this welcoming feeling? She stretched her arms out, fully clothed, and began swimming into the darkness. She thought she heard sounds ahead. Voices, almost cheerful, seemed to be beckoning her to swim out further into the night. Despite the temperature of the water, a warmth started growing in her chest. There was a certain numbing, giddy lightness. She'd felt this way before, the last thought of a conscious mind on the edge of sleep, a delicious pulling or falling sensation. How easy it would be to just give in to it. The numbing feeling began spreading through the rest of her body until she couldn't tell where she ended and the ocean began. She looked back over her shoulder at the lantern on the shore. Seeing now how far it was startled her, a jolt to the stomach as she began splashing around, panic taking over her body. What the hell was she doing out here? She flailed around, water going into her mouth as she tried to center herself enough to swim. Staring at the orange glow of the lantern through the fog, she swam hard back towards it, the desire for life never stronger than in this moment it might be taken away. Her body burned with the effort against the freezing water of the outgoing tide, it gently sucking her back. No wonder she just melted into it as she'd first swum out here. Alice Mauser reached the shore at just gone 9 p.m, throwing herself onto the sand, shaking, panting, both freezing and on fire. The elder, Roger, who'd previously needed assistance to move much at all, found within himself reserves he, nor anyone else, had seen coming. He was spotted early one morning, walking unassisted with only his cane in the direction of the abbey. That evening, he told Alice and Elizabeth, a pleasure so strong on his face that he smiled for nearly an hour straight of what he'd been doing.
I've taken something.
He leant over his garden gate, clearly desperate to be asked what.
I just found it.
He took his hands from behind his back to reveal a copper-coloured bell, not much bigger than a palm.
Well, I took it from the door. From in there.
He pointed his cane towards the abbey, his voice brimming with excitement. He shuffled around to the front of the house, refusing help from the women as he crudely strung up the bell next to his door with a grubby piece of rope.
My luck's changing.
And with that, he staggered back inside, closing the door abruptly, leaving the Mauser cousins to look up at this curious latest addition to the cottage. That night, strange noises were heard coming from the sea once more. Almost infant-like sounds, and that of wind blowing through tree branches way out on the ocean. Roger's neighbour, Anne, said she, too, heard odd noises coming from Roger's house in the early hours, peering out her window to see him running towards the beach, though he had, certainly, not moved so fast in 30 years. The hairs on the back of her neck stood up as she watched his fast body vanish into the mist. Roger, who'd been born in the village, was never seen there again. And that evening, Alice untied the bell from next to his door and took it back to the abbey, where she placed it on a rafter with care. She couldn't say why, only that it was clear it belonged here and shouldn't have been taken. A pressure from her chest lifted as she closed the heavy door behind her. The news of Roger's theft and his consequential disappearance shook the handful of the community that remained. How could they gain the protection that Abby seemed to possess without harming themselves in the process? Roger had clearly believed the bell would be a type of protective talisman for him, but divorced from the grounds of the Abbey, such, it seemed, was the inverse. The remaining neighbours began meeting at the Abbey each night. Nobody planned it, each compelled to walk to what was now the natural focal point of the village. With the nights lengthening, evenings were spent around the large fireplace, toasting to departed friends and enjoying the conversation that had eluded them in the previous months. They had exited the building at dusk, at which point Elizabeth Mauser had started scrabbling around in the dirt near the door of the Abbey, next to the gorse bushes which were currently in blooms of rich gold.
We'll make our own. We'll make our own bells.
With this, she pocketed fistfuls of the sandy earth into her coat, her neighbours watching on before they, too, began clawing at the ground. For the next few hours, the neighbours mixed the earth from the Abbey with clay and fashioned them into their own small ornamental bells, which they each hung from their doors. It had been with a strange satisfaction they'd done so, not entirely sure what had driven them to it, but with the direction and focus that united them in their task. Alice sat down with Elizabeth in their cottage later, as they met each other's eyes, crinkled in the corners with their smiles. It had felt like a long time since they had looked at each other. As Alice studied her cousin, a guilt pricked at her heart, the way she'd sometimes hoped that Elizabeth simply wouldn't come back, that she'd keep walking dreamily into the distance, never to return. Alice's eyes stung as her cousin stared back at her fiercely.
I saw Mum, Alice. I've seen her.
With this, Elizabeth cupped her hands around her own cheeks. Alice put her hands tightly around her cousin and hugged her as she'd never gripped another person before. She wanted to tell Elizabeth how sorry she was, but not sure where to begin. She just held tighter.
I'm sorry about Thomas, Alice.
Alice pulled away from her cousin now, studying her face in the firelight.
What?
Alice had never said a word to her cousin, or anybody, about what had, or rather hadn't happened with the cannon. Alice looked at Elizabeth incredulously, her cousin clearly more on the ball than she'd given her credit for. As the Mauser cousins gripped each other's elbows, the night having fully settled in, a sound was heard from outside their door. It was the noise of church bells ringing all over the village. The cousins opened the door, not being able to pinpoint a direction. Sometimes the bells of Theberton could be heard, but this was different. The sound was coming from the homes of the village, from the clay bells they'd made, their ringing, even though they had no clappers. The noise surrounded them in an ethereal chorus that had no equivalent. They spied their neighbours emerge from their front doors too, all whirling around in the dusk. After this, the villagers slept the deepest they had in almost a year, colours saturating their once sepia dreams like rays of the sun. They woke with pink in their cheeks and vision brighter, like a milky film had been removed from their eyes. From inside their cottages, the quality of the light seemed different too. Doors were flung open to see a bright June morning, the horizon visible across the sea. The horizon visible across the sea. The fog had cleared, not slightly, but completely.
Praise God.
Alice moved stiffly around the cottage, hardly daring it to be true. She brought her hand to the gorse that grew near their front door, dew visibly hanging off the flowers. She'd forgotten what it was to see the details of the landscape, the world recently a place of roughlies and approximations. She studied the plant, not being able to tear her eyes from the minutiae of its beauty. In time, due to the encroaching sea, the remaining inhabitants left Minsmere, settling close by in Eastbridge. The story goes that one day, a handful of people arrived from the marsh, them each carrying small clay bells. They couldn't be parted from them and hung them above the doors of their new homes, future generations being told to never take them down. For ungodly things carried on the waves might seep in one day as you rested in your armchair. Yes, even you. Whilst the younger people never knew what these things were, they recalled the fierce focus the original incomers to Eastbridge had possessed as they'd hung up their talismans from the door, the tradition thus kept alive for many years. A very old woman, who'd once come to Eastbridge with her cousin, and whose chestnut hair was now completely grey, often told the children of the bells of Minsmere, and of the abbey that had somehow contained a certain type of magic, as she'd decided to call it, a power that was too contained in the bells, but that they must be made from scratch, by hand, never stolen from the abbey itself. For the children, she left off the part about the canons, instead telling their parents how she'd once seen the religious men walking in procession along the coast. Sometimes she'd pose questions for her audience. Had the canons been trying to protect the village? Had they deliberately left the abbey as a type of refuge for them? Or was it something else? She realised she was hoping someone would answer for her. Nothing, still, made much sense all these years later, and the old woman with the stories and sea shanties from a community long gone was haunted by the image of the men in the white gowns until her last day. Especially one of them. When she closed her eyes, she still saw him, paused in time, preserved, eternally young. So vivid, so real, she could have reached out and surely felt the warm flesh of the cheek. She continued to take evening strolls, even though this now consisted of not much more than hobbling a few feet from her house. A couple of times, she'd fancied she'd seen a figure in white looking out across the water, just like she'd seen all those years ago. Blinking, it would disappear. It must have been a bit of dust on her eye, or a trick of the light. Still, her heart leapt, the marsh still managing to surprise all these years later. The story of the bells of Minsmere survived for hundreds of years. In the 1940s, a couple lived on the outskirts of Eastbridge in some of the only remaining woodland of the parish. Their two cherished boys went off to war and never came home. The silence of the woods that surrounded their cottage seemed heavier now, as if they solely were existing outside of the world. With no future generations to help with the farm or to take care of the couple, their health quickly declined, and the farm that had once sustained them now ground to a halt. On winter evenings, they were often found looking up at the small earthenware bell that hung in the kitchen next to the door. It was grimy and strangely shaped, it having been mended many times. It elicited peculiar feelings in onlookers. It was ancient, ugly, a key to another time that couldn't unlock. Or perhaps it could. The couple knew the story of the bells, something about sea spirits and a handful of marsh folk who'd shown up in Eastbridge one day. The couple often wondered about the person who carried this bell here. Who had they been? But the ornament was giving nothing up, hanging enigmatically over all their triumphs and trials. At the end of a long day, with no hope and no help left, the woman pointed up at the bell. The man looked deep into her eyes for what may have been minutes. He knew her meaning. They'd never really discussed their belief in such things, and yet here, at the end of their days, questions fell away as an unexpected path forward became clear. The old man took down the bell, and together they crushed it until it was a mass of tiny pieces. They threw these onto the fire, hearts hammering, yet united. They then took this dust outside and sprinkled it into the woods, a type of funeral rite for their own lives. The woman then spoke words that had been passed down to her. It was said there were specific phrases that could be said to the spirits, so long as the need was true. She hadn't thought about them since her mother had spoken them to her, yet now they rolled from her tongue with confidence and weight as the wind whipped the dust around them. This duo, no more schooled in such arts than the average country couple, now walked back to their home with longer strides, appearing as seers of the woods from another ancient time. They opened all the doors and windows in their cottage, then climbed into bed, holding each other as they'd done every night, and waited for what they knew would come. As darkness crept and their bodies lay shivering, tendrils of mist began seeping into their rooms. It was accompanied by almost childlike laughter and chatter, which seemed to be emanating from the woods. Like the old woman's ancestor, Alice Mauser, had felt the pull of the voices that night she'd swum out to sea many hundreds of years ago. The couple felt it too. Unlike Alice, they didn't swim back to shore, but continued holding each other tightly as they gave in to the darkness. For what they realized as they felt each other's heavy exhales on their chins was that there was nothing to be afraid of. They were eventually found cold in their beds, the little bell that had always hung in their door, their neighbors noted, nowhere to be seen. None of the villagers would live in the old cottage after this. It was used for a long time as an animal shed, and by the 1980s was pulled down. There's now a new house that was built nearby, but you won't find a bell in it. Nor will you find talk of the tale in the nearest pub, the Eel's Foot. This is, unfortunately, a folk tale that has almost been entirely forgotten. Please consider adding the Bells of Mensmere to your own folktale repertoire and keep the story of the people who showed up from the coast with the talismanic clay ornaments alive. This isn't the only story of bells on this patch of coast. It's said that on certain calm nights, when there isn't a stirring on the breeze, that just up the beach, the bells of the sunken church at Dunwich can still be heard. An unearthly chiming coming from the water. You've been listening to The Bells of Mensmere, Part 2. Stay tuned for this month's almanac to provide you with some inspiration for the month ahead. Folkways is the work of myself, Ashley, with musician Big Big Sky, who creates scores specifically for each show. If you'd like to hear more from him, you can now join our super exclusive club, the Friends of Folkways. Friends are treasured listeners who choose to support this work, thus helping with our high book and research costs. Friends enjoy lush instrumental soundtracks, perfect to fuel your own creative tasks or to listen to in the bath, as well as other goodies including letters through the post and, coming soon, folklore-inspired meditations. Most importantly, though, they help preserve and celebrate the folk heritage of these islands, which is what this show is all about. Follow the link in the show notes to join. Here you'll also find links, sources, and useful information to help progress your folkloric journey. May the gods of the soil, sky, and the links of your ancestral line bless you. Now it's time to tune into Folkways FM for April 2022's Almanac. I've been informed the ship is currently somewhere in the Irish Sea. Let's try and pick them up. The very warmest of welcomes to April 2022's Almanac, where we take a look at our calendars, the heavens and the hedgerows to try and navigate our way through the coming month. Firstly, let's kick things off with a poem. This is Spring by Gerard Manley Hopkins. Nothing is so beautiful as spring, when weeds in wheels shoot long and lovely and lush. Thrush's eggs look little low heavens, and thrush through the echoing timber does so rinse and ring the ear, it strikes like lightnings to hear him sing. The glassy pear tree leaves and blooms, they brush the descending blue, that blue is all in a rush, with richness the racing lambs too have fair their fling. What is all this juice and all this joy? April, known as Mensis Aprilis in Latin, you'll often get told that the name Aprilis comes from an association with Aphrodite or Venus. For example, Ovid associates April with the goddess. It may also derive from aperire, to open, since this was the month that fruits and flowers blossomed. In Irish, it is Abron, which is borrowing from Aprilis, as is the Welsh Ebrilith. In Scots Gaelic, it is Ingipline, which means pudding month. This may have been a reference to the using up of the final winter stock to make puddings in the traditional sense of the word, which is probably less delicious than you might think. In Manx Gaelic, it is Averil or Gerry Arry, which means the end of spring. Before we cast our eyes up to the heavens, let's have a quick leaf through our calendars. So, the 1st of April is April Fool's Day. Yes, on this day, it is traditional to play tricks on people. I hope you escaped relatively unscathed. Nowadays, universally called April Fool's Day, in early sources, it was primarily All Fool's Day, which reads as either a parody or at least a wry nod to the Christian Church's All Souls Day. The earliest mention appears to be by John Albury in around 1686, who writes, "Fool's Holy Day, we observe it on the 1st of April." Before we go any further, I did want to ask you, have you ever seen the white lions being washed in the Tower of London? So in March 1860, a vast multitude of people received cards through the post inviting them to witness that very thing. According to Robert Chambers in his 1864 Book of Days, the cards read, "Tower of London, admit the bearer and friend to view the annual ceremony of washing the white lions. Sunday, April the 1st, 1860, admission only at the White Gate. Of course, attendees should have looked a little harder at the April 1st part of the invite. The trick is said to have been hugely successful, with cabs rattling around Tower Hill all that Sunday morning, vainly endeavouring to discover this White Gate. There's something quite delightful about that, and interestingly, the account has been connected to various different years, thus obtaining a type of mythic status with, quote, washing lions in the tower, now a saying, which essentially means something is a massive waste of time. As Steve Roud writes, poor old apprentices in various occupations were particularly likely to be targeted on April Fools, and they could be sent to fetch such items as straight hooks, left-handed screwdrivers, or striped paint. Of course, we note that the foolish nature of the day is seen in plenty of other festivals too. We have shades of this in May Day or Beltane, where tricks were played, as well as Twelfth Night in January, and general Yuletide Lord of Misrule shenanigans, and of course, Halloween, which although now mainly revolves around trick-or-treating, traditionally had a hugely subversive streak where the usual societal norms were briefly suspended. It's clear to me that societies demonstrably need this type of pressure valve, a release from the restrictions of the everyday that allow order to ensue. It's actually very clever to give these windows a strict beginning and end time, as we see here. Thus, when the clock strikes, it is over. For April Fools, that time is 12 noon, making the frivolity fairly short-lived. This clearly wasn't working well enough for P.H. Ditchfield, who, after discussing April Fools in his work Old English Customs, haughtily concludes, if only fools and folly could be confined to this brief period. Fair enough, mate. So, next in the calendar is Easter, with the long weekend starting on the 15th this year, Good Friday, and Easter Monday on the 18th. At this time, the humble egg must surely be one of the most ubiquitous symbols representing new life incoming. As Professor Ronald Hutton notes, the medieval prohibition of the eating of eggs in Lent enhanced the exchange of them at the most appropriate season, Easter, when the fast terminated. Today, Lent or no Lent, the egg remains central to our notion of spring and also of better times ahead. We paint them, decorate them, go on extravagant hunts for them, and of course, chocolate companies make a killing from our continued connection with this symbolism. Do you remember last month we noted many customs throughout the year evolved from people going from door to door and essentially asking for scraps of food? Well, roll up, as it's the Easter edition now. Large parish feasts were often held to help feed the poor, and children were sent out to rustle up some grub. As you were minding your own business one day, you might have heard from outside your door,
herrings, herrings, white and red, 10 a penny, Lent is dead, rise dame and give an egg.
If you acquiesced, you were super popular. But if not, you were berated in rhyme, then your door latch might be cut and the keyhole filled with dirt. This begging gradually developed into a more sophisticated form, and by the end of the 18th century in the north of England, had morphed into young men grotesquely dressed, led by a fiddler. Now, rather than demanding, they performed for you, after which you might be inclined to, hopefully, dig deep. The practice actually survived into the 20th century, although the focus became more about getting money or booze than raising food for a festival. The performers were primarily known as peace eggers, or quite sweetly, jolly boys. If you were a lad up in the Highlands of Scotland, you didn't sing for your supper, but rather there was a custom of stealing eggs to make a pancake feast on Easter Day. For hundreds of years, there's also been the tradition of both decorating eggs and rolling them down hills. This has primarily been seen in Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Northern England. Kraken. Finally, on the 23rd of April, it is St. George's Day, England's patron saint. George was an early Christian martyr who died in 303, and despite being England's patron saint, he never appears to have visited England and was likely a soldier in the Roman army. That cool dragon bit appears to have been stitched on later too, with its origin likely from far older stories. So surely if we accept these historical inaccuracies, this makes the figure of George obsolete, right? Well, yes, and also importantly, no. During the Middle Ages, the long-dead George had become an ideal of martial valour and also of selflessness. And it's this ideal that we likely think of when we see the image of the slaying of the dragon. I would argue that these images, or these ideals, as I've said, hold the real power. Talking of martial valour and of the chivalric, we can also apply this thinking to the tales of King Arthur as an example. There's a huge amount of discussion on whether these figures were historical or not, and although we can understand why, to me, this misses something even more intriguing, which is why we give a damn about them in the first place. Why we, as fully grown adults in 2022, continue to connect so powerfully with both these figures and these stories. Clearly, something is being stimulated within our minds, and this is the strength that the mythic holds, something that, unlike George's dragon, can never be slain. If you woke up in Galway on the 1st of April, you saw the sun rising at 7:10 a.m. and setting at 8:11 p.m. Glasgow, the sun rose at 6:48 a.m, setting at 7:54 p.m. And Guildford, the sun rising at 6:38 and setting at 7:35. The new moon is Friday, 1st of April, and you can watch it fattening in the skies until the full moon, which agreeably falls on a weekend this month, Saturday the 16th. So be sure to admire Earth's friend as you sit in pub gardens, or perhaps go for a moonlit stroll or drive. April's full moon is the ecclesiastical moon, which determines the date of Easter. Other names for it include the new shoots moon, budding moon, or the seed moon. We've actually got two new moons this month, with the second falling on the last day of April, Saturday the 30th. Whilst April is famous for showers of the watery kind, we also have some meteor showers this month to look forward to, two of which will be visible in the Northern Hemisphere. The first, the Lyrids, begin April the 14th, running until the 23rd. The second performance will be a shower starting April the 19th and will continue until the end of May. This latter one will be a stronger shower, and you have the best chance of seeing it in later April when the moon is waning, until the peak on May the 6th. Ursa Major, or the Great Bear, is still high overhead, and this large constellation includes the seven stars of the famous Plough. Cassiopeia has now swung around and is almost on the meridian to the north below Polaris. If you'd like to hunt down Polaris, find the plough or the saucepan, and from the top edge of the pan opposite the handle, follow the line and you'll see the shining pole star. This is always a good trick for navigation, as Polaris is above the North Pole, allowing you to find your way home if you ever need to. Hey, one day this could be useful. The constellation of Perseus is beginning to descend into the northwest, following the constellation of the beautifully named Andromeda. The Earth is what we might call quickening at this point of the year. Primrose, violets, wood anemones, and celandines all begin to decorate our hedgerows and verges, and hawthorn begins to green once more as the froth of white blackthorn flowers begin to decline. Consider celebrating this quickening by collecting a handful of such spring flowers for your kitchen table, or spread the love by presenting them to a pal who could do with their colour. Talking of hawthorn, you can eat the early leaves that are now arriving, as I'm sure some of you know. They're nutty, good in salads, and the hedges are pretty much everywhere, making this one of the easiest ways to dip your toes into foraging. Myself and Big Big Sky enjoyed feeding hawthorn leaves to two lovely donkeys we met this month in Great Hawksley, who had the softest, most velvety ears you can imagine. You may also well be familiar with hawthorn trees being sacred to the land of the Fae, and I would be a poor folklore researcher not to warn you of this. Hawthorn should never be cut down or the trees disrespected in any way. April is also the traditional month to collect dandelion and gorse flowers. Gorse flowers, ubiquitous along the coast, can be sprinkled on salads or baked in bread for flashes of gold. You can also find St. George's mushrooms, which appear from mid-April to the end of May, although the 23rd is the traditional date to consume them. I'd like to quote a few lines from The Forager's Calendar by John Wright. A lady once won me in a raffle. She could do with me what she would for a single day, and took the relatively safe option of a mushroom foray. She seemed a little quiet, and I wondered if she was wishing that large box of Ferrero Rocher had been hers instead. We approached the gate of a small wood, and I stopped and expressed the opinion that mushrooms would be found inside, because I could smell them. He continues to write of odour being an important characteristic in identification. St. George's mushrooms have a strong scent that can be described as mealy or like raw pastry, as John opts for. Either way, if you're feeling like cooking up a patriotic meal on the 23rd, then be sure to include them. As always, please thoroughly check all foraged food against a guidebook or with a professional. Finally, I would like to invite you to go on some kind of a spring walk this month. I know I've suggested this at other times, but there's really nothing like seeing that initial push of spring to lift your mood. Yes, the world is still a nonsensical, bizarre place to live, thus we could do with this even more. And what with the longer Easter weekend, this is the perfect time to hopefully treat yourself to a few hours away from your usual routine. Although the almanac has mentioned spring incoming for a couple of months now, April is really the time it begins to feel real and we start shedding our heavier winter coats. Walk a favourite old route of yours, or stick a finger on a map and see what happens, allowing the delights of spring to renew your spirit, which all of us need to do from time to time. It's now time for the next instalment of The Magic Apple Tree by Susan Hill. And as always, you'll find a link in the show notes to get yourself a copy. At 5:30, I get up, slip out, and set off with my bicycle in the glorious morning, up through the empty village, for, on the bicycle, I can see over the tops of hedges and look down the rides towards copse and meadow and all the flat fen. I can go further than on foot through the lanes, getting off whenever I like, to lean on a gate or poke in a ditch, and I love the quiet, silky sound of the tyres on the tarmac road, the click of the chain and the whir of the pedals, like wings when I go fast. No one is up, save a black cat coming home, mouse in mouth. Most of the cottages, which still have thatch, wear nets, like hairnets draped over wigs and pinned down tight against the burrowings and nestings of birds. Once out beyond the last house, I can ride and look over the top of the hawthorn hedge down to the valley below, on the west side of the fen, where a mist is still hanging about in the hollows. This is one of the best views, softer and more wooded than the one from Moon Cottage, where there is so much space and sky, so much flatness. Here, I see more gentle slopes, meadows dotted with clumps of trees, a line of 7 oaks across one field, like ladies in hooped skirts. And there, 5 miles off and beautiful against the sky, are the dreaming spires of Oxford, ethereal, glittering, insubstantial in the pearly, misty air of this early spring morning. And I cannot mind them, if that were all of the city, I should welcome it.
Chippers, get the butter out.